I'm here today with Steve Vigil to talk about the truce in El Salvador. At the end of January this year, the first peace zone was established in El Salvador, launching the second phase of a historic truce between the two largest criminal gangs there, Mara Salvatrucha, also known as MS-13, and Barrio 18, or 18th Street. The truce itself was negotiated in March 2012, so it's now 11 months old. Steve, to begin with, I wonder if you could tell us about the origins of these two gangs, which I believe started in the streets of Los Angeles, California.
Yeah, certainly. It's very common to be mistaken as El Salvadoran gangs. They actually began in Los Angeles. 18th Street is an older gang that's origins date back to the 40s or 50s within the Chicano Mexican-American community in Los Angeles. So it's one of the older generational gangs that's been in existence for a long time. In the 80s, they began accepting Central American immigrants into their gang because, for one, a lot of them were moving into their neighborhoods and as an effort to strengthen their numbers against some of their rivals within Los Angeles. MS-13 began, I believe, in the late 70s, and it was started by Salvadoran refugees who were escaping from the war. And initially, it was not started as a gang. There were the Mara Salvatrucha Stoners. They started as like a heavy metal clique in Hollywood, and with the interactions they had with the police and then with the juvenile system, they began transforming into what was considered a traditional cholo gang from Los Angeles, and they began to have rivalries with some of the other gangs in the area, including 18th Street.
So how did they end up in El Salvador?
After the Los Angeles riots in 1992, California started deporting criminal aliens and actually became federal policy in 1996. It's important to note that in 1992, that was when the peace accords came through, ending the war in El Salvador. El Salvador was in a pretty fragile state at that point, and in 1996, El Salvador started receiving thousands of gang members from California, not just El Salvador, but different parts of Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras were affected by this. It happened at a time when people weren't aware of who the gangs were and what the potential was for violence or the gangs themselves taking root in the country. And also at a time when you had a large number of young people that either did not have their parents, were orphaned through the war, or whose parents were not around because they had immigrated to the United States for work. So it was an unfortunate time for this to take place for El Salvador.
You had experience working on interventions with some of the gang members when they were in the United States, and you then joined a delegation that visited El Salvador last July 2012 to assess the viability of the truce reached in March last year. So who invited you to El Salvador, and what did you find? How sustainable is the truce today?
I started 22 years ago working in communities affected by gang violence. And through that experience, I worked in California and in the Washington, D.C. area with Salvadoran diaspora communities. So I had the opportunity to work with some of these communities back then. I was with an organization called Barrios Unidos out of Santa Cruz, California. When people started getting deported, we were one of the few groups saying that this was not an answer to the gang violence problem in our country. And in fact, it was going to do much to spread that violence to Latin America and to elsewhere in the country, and unfortunately we were proven right. As to being invited to El Salvador, we actually were initially invited by the imprisoned gangs themselves, who were conscious that there had been previous attempts to have truces in El Salvador before, and when they didn't work out, some of the people involved in that were killed or disappeared. The gang leaders facilitated an introduction to Monsignor Colindres, who is one of the facilitators in El Salvador. And then eventually we received a great deal of support from the Salvadoran government. We visited 7 prisons, and we met with the leadership from both gangs in the prisons that we visited, as well as the Minister of Justice, Public Security, his Vice Minister, Director General of Police, Director General for Prisons, NGOs, and international organizations. On the part of the gangs themselves, we found a pretty firm commitment to the process. The leadership and indeed the members that we had the opportunity to speak with in the prisons spoke very clear about what they wanted, not just for themselves, but for their communities, that they wanted to see an end to the violence, and they wanted to see a future for their families as well as the greater Salvadoran society. Amongst the different actors we met with from the government and INGOs and NGOs, the message wasn't necessarily as clear in terms of where they stood in support of or against the truce. There was certainly a lot of skepticism in July when we went there from certain quarters which I think is still somewhat the case, but as the truce has continued, I think people are more open to the idea of what it could potentially bring.
But this skepticism that you talk of, in spite of this dramatic reduction in violence, who is opposed to the truce and why are they so skeptical? What are the complaints that are out there about the way the truce came about?
I think the primary complaint was that the truce did not come about in a very transparent and open manner. I think people felt that there wasn't a clear message coming from the government and the facilitators of the truce about what brought it out. I think that the security industry in Central America has grown exponentially in the last 10, 15 years. So there's some pretty strong economic interest to not see this sort of thing succeed. And that's really unfortunate. And I think that when you have situations where so much emphasis is put on security, it can often get in the way of some of the real progress you need to make so that a society can move past the cycle of violence that has engulfed it. And this is something that a lot of the people we spoke with in El Salvador said was, while they thought the truce was a good thing, the concern was that the general Salvadoran society was going to be the hardest to convince about the truce because those are the people that have the direct experience with actual gangs. We're talking the people who live in the neighborhoods that see the violence and are victims of the violence on a daily basis. One thing that has changed in the last 11 months is now that there is more of a human face on gang members and people are starting to talk about prevention and intervention and reintegration programs that people were not open to speak about a year ago.
Given your work in this area in multiple settings, what are your thoughts on the mano dura approach that seeks to crack down on criminal gangs? Do you think that this really failed in El Salvador? And what are the prospects for this approach elsewhere, given the challenges that organized criminal gangs continue to pose, particularly in that region?
One of the things that came across very clear in our discussions with people in El Salvador, from the Minister of Justice himself to grassroots NGOs working in the communities, to the prison leaders, to clergy, everybody pretty much said that mano dura has been a failure. The idea was to crack down on gangs and on violence, and the opposite has happened. The violence has increased and the gangs have become much better organized. I think it's clear from the people themselves in El Salvador that they don't feel that it's been a success.
So what approach does work, do you think? What are the next steps? And what, in general, do you think should be the approach being taken when talking about criminal gangs?
I think there needs to be a distinction between the organized criminal gangs that are narco-traffickers and that sort of crime that's at a higher level and much better organized and financed. There's been some statements about the Treasury Department making MS-13 a transnational gang. I think that's promoting a misunderstanding that these street gangs are at the same level as much better organized, much better financed criminal organizations. And that's not to say that the street gangs can't get involved in those activities, but I think it's important to note that for the most part, the street gangs are very poor, unemployed, usually uneducated young people who live in barrios, and most of the violence that they're perpetuating is against themselves and against people like them in their own communities. You really have to have some investment at the community level so that people can actually have the opportunities that can lead them out of poverty. One of the problems in the region is high unemployment and high underemployment. I think the issue of inequality is very important. Central America is one of the areas with one of the highest rates of inequality in the world. People don't, by and large, have the opportunities to raise themselves up out of poverty. The structures aren't there to allow them to do so. It's left the door wide open for the rise in urban violence and the criminality that we've seen in the last 10, 15 years in the region.
Talking about poverty, a lot of the street gangs are quite young. I wonder if you could link it to the changing landscape of violence that we're seeing on an international level. Do you see any lessons from El Salvador for elsewhere?
I've worked in UN peacekeeping on and off for the last 12 years in post-conflict settings, and I think it's key to look at El Salvador and Guatemala in relation to an incomplete peace process following the end of the wars there. One of the key things that did not happen was an actual reconciliation process. And not just reconciliation between the conflicting parties, but also reconciliation between the parties and society themselves. Throw in the mix of non-coordination between the U.S. government and the governments in the region in terms of the deportation policy, especially relating to criminal deportees in the initial phases, I think that left the door wide open for a different type of violence to take root. that's a danger that we need to take into account when we're looking at a lot of our post-conflict countries, because they're experiencing the same sort of thing. You've got a youth bulge that's coming up, which tends to be, for the most part, under or uneducated with limited opportunities for employment and education, and many of whom had fought in the conflicts that they are coming from. I think you're looking at people fighting for the basic levels of survival, and different criminal groups, whether organized or not, are capitalizing on this. And that needs to be something that humanitarians and development professionals take into account as they're moving forward to the next generation.
Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us, Steve.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.